Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today has spent 35 years working in television news and worked for NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN, Fox, and the BBC. Tim Ortman is an Emmy Award-winning cameraman and producer with experience in shooting, lighting, editing, writing, and producing. His assignments have taken him to five continents, covering war, revolution, famine, terrorist attacks, and the fall of communism. On the back cover of his memoir, Newsreel, A View Through the Lens, when news journalist Tom Brokaw writes, Tim Ortman has done aspiring broadcast journalists a great favor with his inside real-deal trip through the life of a rock star cameraman. He's been there, done that, and you can go along for the ride. Buckle up. That was Tom Brokaw speaking there about Tim Ortman. Tim Ortman, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, Nancy.
I noticed that Tom Brokaw picks up on your title when he refers to your real-deal trip, because the title of your book, Newsreel, is a play on words. You spell it news, R-E-A-L. And do people wonder why you wrote this book?
Well, I spelled it Newsreel specifically to take on the topic of fake news that is so prevalent in our lexicon today. As it's applied to the mainstream news, I don't subscribe to the fake news topic. I think that it's a diversionary tactic, a smokescreen to divert the reader or the listener's attention from stories that are at their heart factually correct, but may not be very complimentary or flattering. So that label news, or that label, the label fake news is applied in an attempt to distract the reader. But stories that, you know, may not be flattering, it doesn't mean that they're untrue. And I think we need to keep sight of that.
Well, in fact, I noticed that Tom Brokaw calling you a rock star cameraman notwithstanding, because you did win awards and compliments. But you also are very honest about yourself as you go through this book. And I wondered if your first draft, if you were so honest about, say, your relationship with your wife and your friend Fifi, in your first draft, were you that honest about these experiences?
I was not. I mean, I think I did a wonderful job of recalling the news stories that I was fortunate to cover working for NBC News as part of the Foreign Press Corps. We really did kind of circle the globe and had a front row seat on a number of historic events. And I thought I did a wonderful job in recounting those, but I didn't do a very good job, I was told, in opening up my emotions and my heart. And so on numerous subsequent drafts, we did delve a little deeper into me and my motivation and what I was thinking and feeling. And I remember reading a quote by Ernest Hemingway, and he said, you know, writing is really easy. You just sit over a typewriter and bleed. So
my guest is Tim Ortman, and he has written a memoir, Newsreel, about his experiences as primarily overseas with NBC News. And I'll tell you, Tim, you were quite successful when you were recounting these stories. I mean, I was right there with you every step of the way. And sometimes it would be a jolt to come back to, oh, here's reality. I'm really sitting in my house reading this book. And when I was overseas with you at every step of the way, because I've had some of the similar, not as exaggerated as yours, but some similar experiences, because at the age of 25, I went overseas to live for a year in a country that was somewhat unstable. And I, like you, I was rather innocent. And I didn't realize until afterwards, wow, you know, I got out of that country without being thrown in jail for whatever reason. I got tear gassed. But so I identified with what you were saying about, as a 25-year-old, off you go you went to Europe with the innocence of a young man of 25. How did that come about?
I was very fortunate, too, at an early age, who've been given an opportunity to work with NBC News. And at the time, that I think that was truly the heyday, the golden era of international broadcast news coverage. There were really only four networks. CNN had just come on the scene, and they had enormous audiences. And with enormous audiences, you have enormous budgets. So we had bureaus in every capital and major city around the world. And I was thrust into this huge global news covering machine, and it took me a while to really understand the arena, the theater in which I was playing. But I had, throughout that whole time, I developed a real sense of camaraderie with the other dedicated men and women that, like me, were covering news. And I, you know, quickly became supremely proud of working for the NBC news team and the much larger broadcast news business. And that's, you know, one of the reasons, and you mentioned the title of the book, News Real, and why I wanted to confront this fake news phenomenon, that, you know, it's important to remember that the good, incredible work being done on behalf of journalists, really dedicated journalists back then and still today, very much so.
My guest is Tim Ortman. He was a cameraman during the heyday of television news, and his memoir is Newsreel, A View Through the Lens, When. And you started it. I mean, you didn't have connections in New York. You were a Midwest guy. You started out in Chicago, which is a good place to start, because I was shocked at how rapidly you caught the attention of people who were the decision makers.
When I was going to school at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, you know, like many kids, I had a chance to work and earn some money on the side, and I could work at the cafeteria or the library or the PBS station. There was a full-blown TV station that was operated by the university. So being a journalism and TV production major, I decided to work at the TV station. So I came out of college with a very good resume and portfolio that work I had done, and got a job at the NBC station in my hometown of Ohio, which I quickly outgrew and started sending out material to bigger cities. And Chicago was in my backyard, and I was lucky to get some interest from the NBC station there. And shortly thereafter, they moved me up there. And because it was an owned and operated station by the network, there was a network bureau there in the Chicago station, WMAQ. And I recount in the book how it was, you know, the dream of every young cameraman or reporter or producer or editor to go and do some part-time duty at the network. And I did, and that's how I caught that. I didn't realize at the time I was catching the eye of the higher-ups, but it happened rather quickly, and I was they were expanding their European operation, and I became part of that expansion.
Well, you might also mention the fact that there was another person who was involved in this your trajectory, and that was your wife, and you are honest about your discussion with her, and yet I don't you're honest with the reader, but not necessarily with her in the beginning. What happened there?
Well, she was incredibly supportive, and I've talked to her still to this day repeatedly, and she had input on the book, and just to make sure that my facts were correct and I was recalling things from that era correctly. We were, you know, went to high school together, went to college together, and shortly thereafter, I started getting these really fortuitous breaks and was moved to Chicago, and a year and a half later, was moved overseas with a staff position with the network. And, you know, each time it took us farther and farther away from our family and our comfort zone. And, but she each time it was an adventure as well. But it was my adventure primarily, and I hesitated to probably consider her situation as much, because I was it's very intoxicating to be hired by NBC News at 25 and moved overseas. So we were very tight, but the news and the job started becoming more and more a part of my life, and traveling abroad. And to these, early on, we would go to Stories together. She could be part of the crew, and we'd jump in the car and drive to Switzerland or France or wherever it was. But when it became more and more hazardous and perilous, you know, she couldn't come along, and I wouldn't really want to put her into that position. And I became, like so many jobs, it became a wedge between us. And when I, later on, when I was in Beirut, I found myself in some serious peril, and another female journalist helped me out of it. And we had, from that point on, formed a bond. And she also became a very close friend, and one I miss still to this day.
Well, you do generate empathy for both you and your wife, because we understand you're so passionate about your career, and yet we also understand your wife's name was Amy. I assume that is her real name.
Yes.
Because in the beginning, you make the usual statement that you had to change some names to protect the people involved. But we can also understand Amy, because she, when you're in Germany, she can't work. She has to sit there and worry about you if when you go to a war zone. And so we're very sympathetic to for both of you. We want to cheer you on in your career, and yet we feel, but poor Amy is stuck there, and she is long-suffering for up to a point. Now, you did mention that you went to Beirut, and I think one thing that surprised you was that you expect there, because in the States and in New York City, there is competition between the networks, NBC, CBS, there's competition. And yet you arrive in Beirut, and this German CBS newsman named Kurt surprised you. And how did he surprise you?
Well, that's that camaraderie, that bond that I referenced. It was omnipresent. Yes, there was a significant competition. Everyone wanted to be first and get the story and break the news first and beat the competition, but not at the expense of anyone. And there, when we weren't crashing deadline or trying to break an exclusive story, there was a lot of time to develop friendships, and not just within NBC, but throughout that broader broadcast news organization. So, yeah, I clearly must have looked like a fish out of water at 25 years old, landing in Bonn. This incredible capital where East meets West, and a lot of intrigue, and it was all very new to me. And the bureau, NBC's bureau, was actually based in Frankfurt. I was kind of a satellite part of that bureau. I would go down and be part of the Frankfurt bureau, but I resided in Bonn so that I could be kind of a journalist watching the international happenings there in Bonn. And this CBS cameraman, you know, befriended me the first time we were in their version of Congress, the Bundestag, and led me around and showed me, you know, this is the best vantage point, and when things are really, when there's news breaking, this is what you want to do. And we did become friends. We'd go out and have beers, and Amy and I would join, he and his wife, and we had a friendship that lasted years later.
Do you remember the advice that Kurt had for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was at that point that wasn't, I would see him in Beirut and things like that. But the advice was, you know, steering me in the right direction, particularly in Bonn, because it was like Washington, D.C. It was a complex town with a lot going on. So it was mostly keeping me out of trouble and not making a fool of myself so that my superiors in Frankfurt would notice. And well, it was all very helpful.
He also mentioned, for example, he was saying there's a few tricks you should know about, and he pointed to plugs built in the wall, and he mentioned your sound man, and your sound man changed from time to time, but you developed a close relationship with your sound man.
I had, oftentimes you change partners. And that was the case with me when I first landed there. I had a wonderful young man, a French young man who my bureau chief, who'd hired me, hired to bring on as my sound man. He spoke five languages fluently and knew Europe inside and out. And he was had traveled, worked as a Lufthansa flight attendant. But he wasn't terribly versed in news coverage or production. And I don't think he shared my desire to go all over the world, and particularly places like Beirut and see the front lines of journalism. So eventually he left the network, and I was partnered up with an older, wiser, more savvy German soundman who had worked for German television for years and years and years. And we didn't have, because of the age gap, we didn't have as much in common as my first soundman, Philippe. But Fred, my German soundman, was just exactly the partner that I needed at that time. He was, hardworking and didn't care where we went, wanted to be part of the story and part of our team. And we did develop a really close bond. And I stayed with him until NBC moved me to Rome, Italy, 4 or 5 years later.
Well, I was amused at the nickname you acquired. You acquired the nickname BBC, which sounds impressive. Wow, they called him BBC? Then you tell us, what does BBC stand for?
It stood for the Bon Baby Crew. And that was there was a lot of friendship, but there was also a lot of healthy ribbing going on. And Philippe and I think we were both 25 years old, grossly inexperienced and much younger than our colleagues. Remember, a lot of the cameramen and producers and correspondents that we would be working with, whether at NBC or our competitors, they had all graduated from Vietnam or the Cypriot War or the fall of Iran, and they had these extensive resumes. And I thought I had pretty good chops covering the mean streets of Chicago and local news, but it really didn't compare to the experience of the colleagues I'd be working with. So we, that's one of the reasons I was in a hurry to get to Beirut and be part of these main stories, these headline grabbing stories, because I thought it was a chance for me to, learn and get up to speed in a hurry and try and catch up or diminish the dearth in experience between me and my colleagues.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll continue my conversation with my guest, Tim Ortman, author of Newsreel, A View Through the Lens, When. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, award-winning cameraman and producer Tim Ortman. He spent 35 years working in television news and has written about his experiences on overseas assignments with NBC in a memoir, Newsreel, A View Through the Lens, When. Now, there came, and I remember when this came up, people thought, oh, we've discovered the diaries of Hitler. And how did you get involved in the Hitler diaries?
I had just landed. I think that was one of the main stories. And if you can imagine, the diaries of Adolf Hitler, I mean, the world ascended on Hamburg, Germany, which is where a very famous German news magazine was based. Der Stern.
Yeah.
Was similar to our time in Newsweek, and when they had reported that one of their journalists had uncovered Hitler's diaries, there was this voracious appetite for that story. And being new and green, and I thought, wow, what a find, you know. So everybody came to Hamburg to cover the story, and there were a few more seasoned journalists who were a little skeptical and said, hold on just a second here. Let's talk about authenticity and let's verify these jurors. And of course, with scrutiny, it became clear that they were forgeries, very good forgeries, but forgeries nonetheless, and that the journalist had paid for them to be forged. And Der Stern was certainly, it was an embarrassment for them. But I write in the book, it was embarrassment for all of us, because many of us, the mainstream news media, had been duped and bought into it a little too quickly. And so I from that point on, I was a little bit more skeptical of headlines like that.
Well, there you are in Bonn. Amy's living there in Bonn with you, but you're itching to get where the action is. And so what did you request?
Well, the number one story at the time was the war in Lebanon. And it had been raging on for years. The Civil War broke out in 76, I believe. And the Israeli army in 82 had just pushed the Palestinians out of Beirut. And the multinational force, peacekeeping force, made up of French, British, Italian, and American troops, were sent in to try and keep an eye on things and keep a lid on everything. And it seemed like every night that was leading nightly news, and every week it was the front cover of Time and Newsweek. And I just had to be a part of it. I had to see it for myself. So I pleaded with my boss is Teddy, my bureau chief, the guy who brought me over there and pretty much felt responsible for my very naive well-being and my safety. Understandably so, they pushed back from this 25-year-old kid who was pleading to go into the cover the war. But within a few months, they acquiesced, and I was sent in, and it was... You know, I had a simplistic view of it. I thought it was, you know, good versus evil. But it was really difficult once I got there to discern who was good and who was evil, because there were, I think, 82 different militias all fighting for different causes on the same, you know, piece of ground down there. So,
for example, you say that the Israeli army equaled the good guys, therefore their enemies were the bad guys, and that black and white view became a kaleidoscope of gray, you say that in your book, that a band of fighters, Muslim fighters who I'd never met before and possessing vastly different world views from my own, would feel responsible, accountable for me to the point of risking their own necks to save mine was astounding. The fact that they'd stood their ground against their own bigger and stronger Syrian allies, who'd had other ideas for us, was even more amazing. And you said, especially after 9/11, it became easy to put anyone or anything associated with Islam in the bullseye. But this was long before Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, and ISIS would become household names. And then you say, to this day, I still have an incredible amount of respect for those courageous Muslims who saved my bacon. And that's pretty dramatic. How did they save your bacon?
Well, one of the first... shortly after arriving in Beirut my first time, I was sent to a mountain range, the Shuf Mountains, which are lie just to the east of the city of Beirut.
Yeah, when I was reading your book, I pulled out Google Maps and I was looking at these places that I wasn't familiar with, these mountains you're referring to.
Yeah, and the story that was taking place up there was after moving the Palestinian Liberation Organization army from Beirut, the Israeli army took positions up in those mountains, and that was their vantage point to kind of keep tabs on everything in Beirut and make sure that the PLO didn't return. So the next big story was the withdrawal of the Israeli army from those mountains back to southern Lebanon and eventually Israel. So we needed to go up and get pictures. So we staked out this inevitable, you know, movement of Israeli military equipment, which never happened. And we were there 3 or 4 days, and we couldn't, you know, we knew they were going to withdraw back to Israel, but it didn't happen. So we came back to Beirut and assumed regular duty there. And then I remember a producer running up to me and saying, "It's happened. You got to get back up there." And I said, "We just came from there." I was skeptical. And he said, "No, it's happening." So sure enough, and we had there weren't really hotels or anything like that. We had taken up a kind of abandoned guest house. It was, you know, in its day, kind of luxurious. But during the war, it had been evacuated, so there was no running water, and electricity were not always constant or givens. So. But it was a great place for us to watch this withdrawal, this military withdrawal. And sure enough, on that second trip we did one night at about midnight, we saw this enormous convoy of these trucks with their headlights on a distant ridge moving south, heading back to Israel. And you know, they were letting off their gunfire was there, but it was more celebratory gunfire. And about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, the convoy disappeared, and within hours, an enormous battle erupted. And what I nobody realized was that when the Israeli presence left the Shuf Mountains, they were the authority. There was no police force there, and a huge battle ensued to try and take over control of territory. There were Christian towns that had been held for centuries that the Muslim militias would battle for, and there were Muslim towns that the Christian militias would fight for. And this was this battle raged on for, I think it was 4 or 5 days. We were trapped. The roads around had been mined. Snipers were everywhere, and the artillery was just raining down relentlessly. And I remember hearing, it was my first time in the middle of a battle like that, and you could hear the different kinds of explosions, knowing one was a mortar shell, one was a rocket, one was a shot from an airplane. And so we dared not move, and we were told by the Muslim militia, because we were in a Muslim-held territory, that if there was ever an opportunity, a lull in the battle, they would try and get us out. But to try and escape on our own would have been suicidal. So we adhered to their very sage advice and waited and waited and waited, and hoping that this Muslim militia would help us deliver us to safety. And one morning they sure did. There were 3 Jeeps with 50 caliber machine guns mounted on the back of them, and they we scrambled to put our belongings back in our mode of transportation was a 1968 Dodge Charger at that point. That was our crew car.
Well, you know, often, Tim, when I'm reading your book, it seemed like a cliffhanger, the old movies where you think, how is he going to get out of this? And when I would be reading such a scene like you were painting now, but I think, well, no, he had to survive because he wrote this memoir. So I would remind myself, no, he does make it out. I don't know how, but he makes it out. So there were several times when I was reading your book that this feeling came up. Now, there was another assignment. You went to Ethiopia, and it really, from what you say, it made a lasting impression, what you saw there in Ethiopia.
I get asked often if I have a favorite assignment, and I always respond, I don't have a favorite assignment. But I have probably a most unforgettable assignment, and that was being assigned in Ethiopia. The BBC had broken a story about a famine in northeastern Africa, stretching across from Chad to Ethiopia, and thousands of people were dying, but there was no media outlet down there, so nobody had any reliable information until the BBC broke this story. And right after they broke it, we, again, because we had bureaus around the world, we could mobilize, and we were very agile. we went in, myself and Martin Fletcher from Tel Aviv. I had my German sound man, and we were met by producer and editors from London. And we all, just getting to Addis Ababa at the time was very difficult. And this famine was in a very remote portion of Ethiopia. And there was a civil war going on there. So it was kind of perilous just getting there. But we did. And when we got, we rented a single engine plane with a bush pilot who'd flown up there, and he flew us up, and we had to make daily sorties. We'd fly up in the morning and come back in the afternoon to deliver the tape to be edited and transmitted to New York. And that first day when we flew up to this dusty little airstrip, and we were met by this dusty Jeep by one of the NGOs, and we came across a ridge, and there was just this vast camp, this refugee camp, and not like a camp in today's definition. There were no real tents. It was just a bunch of makeshift rags that people had put together to try and escape the blazing, you know, African Saharan heat. And there were a couple of Red Cross tents that were put up to handle the worst cases, but it stretched on for seemingly forever. And these people had just crawled for days or weeks through the desert to try and get some water or a morsel of grain or
Your
something.
Your description of the people who were suffering is just, it's hard to imagine that. And then you say, you write in your book, there were very few relief supplies for this growing camp of tens of thousands as aid was just beginning to trickle in. Grain would arrive in burlap bags, and the bags would then be recycled to wrap the corpses of children for burial. Shallow graves filled the outskirts of the camp, and this scene stretched on for miles. And the stretch of torment in front of us was just one of many camps that would populate the region. And so it's hard to imagine that scene. You say, we interviewed doctors and aid workers for whom I developed so much respect and admiration. They were frantically trying to keep up, but were losing the battle on many fronts. The famine was taking countless victims through starvation, dehydration, and disease. The interviews we conducted were impassioned pleas to the international community for greater and faster assistance. They needed everything, food, water, medical supplies, shelter, clothing, and volunteers. And often, toward the end of your book in particular, you make the point that we here in the United States don't really know much about the rest of the world now. But then, back when you're observing this famine, people did respond, and they knew about this, and this global outcry helped bring some relief.
It's when you see horror like that and devastation and suffering, you know, it's very easy to put aside politics and cultures, and you just feel for your fellow human being there. And, you know, those people did nothing to deserve that kind of suffering, but the creeping desert had wiped out their once fertile villages, so they had nothing. And again, that's the power of the press. And I think we are today, with all the media bashing, we kind of forget all the good that's done. But yes, those images and those reports went out quickly, and the United States and a number of other countries donated millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. And the live aid concerts from Wembley in England and Philadelphia generated more tens of millions of dollars. And it was good to see that impact that those news reports had, because, like I said, before the BBC started reporting on it and we joined force, no one knew of that unimaginable suffering.
My guest is Tim Ortman, and he has written a memoir about his experiences as an overseas cameraman for NBC. The title of his memoir is News Reel, A View Through the Lenses When. So after Ethiopia, there's a developing story in the Philippines. And you mention in your book that you grew to admire the Filipino people. And you might just briefly remind people what was in the news there. In fact, it was such a news story that Tom Brokaw comes to Manila. I've always liked Tom Brokaw, and this little human touch made me like him even more. Do you remember what you wrote in your book, that Tom Brokaw comes across this little kid shooting basketball hoops?
Sure. Tom Brokaw, I had the privilege to work with Tom for a number of years, starting overseas, and then continued when I came back to the States. And he was the journalistic beacon that we all followed. We were very fortunate to follow, and he was a model of professionalism and integrity. But he was the face of the network, the anchor man. And so I was a little, when I was paired up with him, you know, I was a little taken back because you could get no higher in journalism than Tom Brokaw. But he was incredibly easy to work with and had no airs about him whatsoever. And the story was that Cory Aquino, who was the widow of a slain opposition figure, Nino Aquino, she decided to run against Ferdinand Marcos, who was a U.S.-backed strongman dictator. And I was told to go down there and cover it, and I'd be back in a couple of weeks. Well, just to be safe, I got myself a visa because I was in Bonn, and I could walk into the embassy of the Filipino Republic, and I got an embassy, so I could stay indefinitely, even though nobody thought we'd be there past a couple of weeks. So in the election, there was a lot of fraud, and the Filipino people called for action and strikes, and they knew that Cory Aquino had won the election, but it was being stolen from her. So a lot of people came in at that point in time to see this election, and Tom was one of them. And so on election day, we were out in these little tiny villages to see if there was any intimidation or anything. And we couldn't find any evidence of, you know, intimidation on either party. But there was, at this one little dusty village, there was a makeshift basket that had been nailed to one of the thatched hut roofs. And there was a little kid shooting baskets. And Tom paused, and the kid looked at this Western journalist and passed him the ball, and Tom shoots and scores, and they spend a few minutes shooting baskets together. It was almost Norman Rockwellian in its purity. It was hilarious, and I still remember it to this day. And covering the elections in the Philippines, and Tom could take a break from his day.
Well, you say that the longer you stayed in the Philippines, the more I began to understand and admire the Filipino people. In most other countries, supporters of the former regime would have been dragged through the streets. But the Filipinos seemed more about embracing rather than hatred, and they were happy instead of angry. That's nice.
I thought they were incredibly empathetic, loving people. And exactly. I mean, they had just removed from power a U.S.-backed strongman. I mean, he was propped up by the United States for good reason. There was, the largest naval base outside of the United States was in Subic Bay, and they had a very important strategic air base, Angeles Air Force Base there in the Philippines. So it was in the United States' best interest to have good relationships with whoever was in government. But it was, I have to give President Reagan a kudos here, because it was the Reagan administration, when it became apparent that Marcos had stolen the election, they were the ones that told Marcos to cut quick and cut clean and get out of there. And they arranged transportation to Hawaii, and Cory Aquino assumed the presidency.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll continue my conversation with my guest, Tim Ortman, author of Newsreel, A View Through the Lens When. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, award-winning cameraman and producer Tim Ortman. He spent 35 years working in television news and has written about his experiences on overseas assignments with NBC in a memoir, Newsreel, A View Through the Lens, When. Well, you indirectly referred to kind of your extracurricular activities besides the work you were doing for NBC, and you did mention your friend who you call her Fifi in the book, and as I'm reading along, I thought, gosh, you must be have given her this name to protect her identity, like you say in the beginning. But I said, Tim, Fifi, that's a dog's name. And it bothered me the whole book, saying, Fifi?
But I think that's in our culture, our nomenclature. Yeah, in our lexicon, that is a dog's name. But Fifi was this incredibly talented, dedicated, one-of-a-kind photographer. And I'd never met anyone like her, and we formed an incredibly close bond for a number of years. And she was a former French runway model who decided that wasn't the life she wanted to lead. And so she just packed up and left and went to Southeast Asia to cover Vietnam as a photographer. And she didn't know anything about photography, but found out she could sell some photographs and make money, and that would be her, you know, keep her traveling. And she became very good at it. And she was incredibly courageous. And she was one of the few, I think the only photographer after the United States military had left Saigon. She was there was one NBC cameraman, film cameraman, and Françoise de Mulder is Fifi's name.
Yes, you don't tell us that, though, during the story. We're reading through the whole book, and you only call her Fifi. It's not till we get to the end of your book, after you've told these stories, that you tell us her real name is Françoise. So I'm guessing, yes, that must have been who she really was.
Yeah, she captured the North Vietnamese tanks crashing through the gates at the presidential palace. So everybody else had gone, but there was this one French female photographer, and she carried that courage with her to the next story, which happened to be Beirut, and she witnessed a horrible genocide, murdering spree in these Palestinian villages where the Christian militias went for a weekend and just killed a number of thousands of men, women, and children. And she caught these really haunting photographs, and it won her the esteemed World Press Photo of the Year, and she was the first female recipient ever to receive that award. So it really did put her on the national stage. But she remained incredibly accessible and lived in the Commodore Hotel to cover that story. And I think in calling her Fifi, everybody just assumed she was one of the boys and a very lovable but admired figure down there.
My guest is Tim Ortman, and he was a cameraman for NBC News during the 1980s, and his memoir is Newsreel, A View Through the Lens, When. Now, you had a chance to go to Libya, and if people recall much of their history with Libya, they know the name of Muammar Gaddafi. But when you went to Libya, here you're all set to cover the story, and this heat you describe remind me of the heat that Europe and the United States suffered this past summer. There you are in the heat with no air conditioning, and I went through that last summer. But I also, my experience with Arabs, I taught English to them for a while, and I remember two words. I don't know much Arabic, just some isolated words, but I do know the word bokra, which means tomorrow, and of course, inshallah, you encounter that all over the place. And so you get there, and they're saying, oh yeah, tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow. So I'll bet you heard that Arabic word bokra a lot. And then you, as a wine fan, were treated to an interesting little scene at a restaurant. They don't drink wine now, and I knew that from my work with the Arabs from Saudi Arabia. They don't drink wine. So what did you order in this restaurant?
Well, yeah, you touch upon a story in Libya, and the by then I had moved to Rome and was part of the Rome Bureau, still a staff cameraman for NBC News, and the staff there had found this story where they were celebrating the 20th anniversary of Muammar Gaddafi coming to power. So not a whole lot of Western news outlets jumped on this, and because it was going to be difficult to get in and get approval. And, you know, this was a celebration for the Arab world and not so much for NBC News. But we persevered. We got our visas. We went in. And because we're Western media, we weren't given the best accommodations. Matter of fact, we were given the worst accommodations. And we were put in a dilapidated, hotel that did not have air conditioning. So the only way to try and live through the stifling heat was to keep your doors and windows open throughout the 24 hours a day, which which was fine. But then we were there to work. We wanted to show what life in Libya was like, and not just the celebration, but the day-to-day life. And of course, that was completely forbidden, off limits. Let's go out and shoot the preparations for the parade. No, you can't do that. Let's go shoot what life in the souk or the market is like. No, you can't do that. So, and we were, we had a government minder watching our every move. So it was very frustrating. And so all we could really do is go to dinner. So there were some nice restaurants we would find and go to. And because it's the Islamic Republic, there's no alcohol served. But we ordered a Coca-Cola, and they would bring a large liter bottle of Coca-Cola and present it like it was, a Lafitte Rothschild or some rare wine from Bordeaux or something, and present it. Let me read the label. Pour me a sip to make sure that it was fine and wasn't off. And I thought the guy was pranking. We were pimping me, I thought he might, or punking me, it was, I realized, no, this is, they want to try and embrace Western culture, even though they can't serve the real thing, the forbidden alcohol. So
that brings me to what you, are more involved in now, because as a fan of wine, you eventually became a certified sommelier with the Court of Master Sommeliers, and you joined the Confrérie des Chevaliers du Test Vin.
Well done, yes. That's a mouthful, isn't it?
It is quite a mouthful, and yet this little test vin is not a mouthful. tell us what that little thing is.
Well, I had, because I was so young and I moved overseas when I was 25, I mimicked what everybody else was doing, and that was they were having a glass of wine at every meal, whether it was lunch or dinner or after dinner. And I jumped in, and I didn't want to be the only guy at the table drinking Diet Coke, so I would take a glass of whatever anybody else was drinking or everybody else was drinking. And I developed an appreciation for wine, and when I came back to the States, I continued on that. So,
well, when I was reading your book, I was reading this to a friend of mine about the Confrérie des Chevaliers du Test Vin, and he said, well, actually, my dad was an honorary member of that, and they gave him this little test vin, this little thing you wear around your neck for tasting wine. So, You even produced your own wine?
Yeah, that's I would caution anybody, because the wine world is a very slippery slope. You start buying an occasional bottle for the weekend, and next thing you know, you've got a cellar full of wine, and you've dedicated all of your luxury income to wine. And it's wonderful. I've made a number of friends through my experiences in the wine world. And the Chevalier is a French group started in the Depression era to promote French Burgundy wine, and it's quite an honor
joke
to be
about how to make a small fortune with your winery.
Yes, I do.
Start with a large fortune. what is your favorite wine, by the way?
Because I've been elected into the Chevalier du Test Vin, I would have to say Burgundy is one of them. And because I lived for so many years and traveled for so many years afterwards. In Italy, I have a real fondness for Italian red wines as well. So,
well, I do want to let the readers know that you have a lot more adventures described in your book. For example, your involvement in communism. You had quite some adventures there. And as I don't want to spoil it for the reader, because at a point in your book, you're saying, okay, I'm going to wrap up this chapter of my life. I'm going to go back to the United States and become a freelance cameraman. And just as we think, oh, okay, all these adventures are over, by George, you go to Prague and you get beaten up. I shouldn't spoil it for people, because I think they will enjoy reading your book for themselves, Tim. So let me remind them, the title of your book is Newsreel, A View Through the Lens Win. And the author is Tim Ortman. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you. It was wonderful being here, Nancy.
You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.